dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the War of Ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a part of that war that has long troubled me and my colleagues at the Center for Security Policy and a team of people with whom we work around the United States is the war on the home front. Too few of us even appreciate that there is a problem on the home front, even though we're speaking to you a couple of days after the latest terrorist attack on American soil involving a Saudi aviator who shot up the Pensacola Naval Air Station. A man who is under no illusion about the fact that we do face enemies within, some of them imported, as in that case, and others people who have become, as they say, homegrown and very dangerous indeed, but not just because of the violent kind of jihad, but because of what others, including members of the Muslim Brotherhood in the United States, call civilization jihad. Our guest for a full hour to discuss these topics, particularly through the prism of an important new book he's just published, Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, How Boston Became a Center for Islamic Extremism. His name is Ilya Feoktistov. He is a terrific freedom fighter, now the executive director of Americans for Peace and Tolerance, an attorney by training, and an incredible writer and producer and champion of freedom in a time that it is being tested as arguably never before, particularly in his hometown of Boston. Ilya, it's so good to have you back. Thank you for joining us and for giving us a full hour of your time to talk about your book and its thesis and your personal experiences in fighting the terror in Boston.
Thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, it's both heartfelt and I think appropriate. Let me ask you, Ilya, about sort of a dramatic figure in what has happened to Boston. Sort of captures the larger problem of the Muslim Brotherhood and its civilization jihad in the United States. Would you introduce us to the person of Abdurrahman Alamoudi, his background and the role that he particularly played in getting the Brotherhood up and running in Boston?
Sure. So as my book describes, Abdurrahman Alamoudi founded an organization here in Boston called the Islamic Society of Boston, which has been responsible for a lot of radicalization happening in the Boston area. But Abdurrahman Alamoudi, when he founded the mosque, and this was in 1982 and throughout the 80s and 90s, was a very prominent individual who was involved with both the Clinton and the Bush campaigns until shortly after 9/11. He was indicted and ultimately sentenced to jail for financing al-Qaeda and participating in an assassination plot. So he perfectly encapsulates the sort of twin dangers we're dealing with, both as far as infiltration and actual kinetic violent terror, as we've seen.
And what's so important about that, Ilya, it seems to me is, and you understand this very well, I think probably our listeners do too, but just to put a fine point on it, the goal, whether it's pursued through this sort of stealthy, subversive, I think of it as pre-violent form of jihad or the violent kind, the goal is absolutely the same, isn't it? And how would you define what the goal of these, I call them Sharia supremacists, is?
Well, the mosque actually teaches a radicalization program it calls Tarbiyah, and all the materials, all the books that they read tell them that everything that they're doing in terms of, you know, following the religion is all just for preparation for the final goal, which is to create the dominion of God over the whole earth, dominion of Allah, and to rule under Sharia law. And that's whether it's done through democratic means or whether it's done through violent means, the goal is the same. And that's the subversion of our system of government and the creation of a new government, basically a violent Islamist revolution, ultimately, whether now or later, is the only difference.
Yeah, I want to come back to this point about, you know, the forms that this pre-violent, violent jihad takes. Ilya, but one of the things that you've studied closely, I know, is an incredibly important work, it seems to me, insofar as it was written by a top Muslim Brotherhood operative, Muhammad Akram, back in 1991, not for our consumption, but for the benefit of the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. And it was discovered and introduced into evidence providentially by the United States government in the Holy Land Foundation trial. And I just wondered, do you have at hand the mission statement of the Brotherhood that he described? Because it really puts such a fine point on the observation that you just made.
I have it close, but essentially this document, which they call the General Strategic Goal for North America for the Muslim Brotherhood, was an internal document written basically as a sort of business plan for the next several years. And what I've investigated about this document, and there's been a lot of sort of mainstream dismissal of the importance of this document. It was just a thought experiment. One of the main people arguing this is a Georgetown law professor. But as I've investigated, this document had real world sort of feedbacks. You could see the actual plan being followed. And I'll explain what I mean in a second. But what the document says is that the process of settlement is a civilization jihadist process with all the word means. The Brotherhood must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying the Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all other religions. And then it has a business plan, which we see later actually being implemented in other documents released as evidence in the Holy Land Foundation case. There's massive amounts of different documents released, and these are implementation plans.
So in short, Ilya, we have to pause here just for a moment, but we're on notice that the enemy within is here to take us down. And we even know the playbook by which they're doing it. And that has a stealthy component as well as a violent kind. We're going to talk about your experiences, Ilya Feoktistov, in Boston as a case study of how this has worked and the kind of help, amazingly, that the brothers and their friends have gotten from the infidels. That and much more straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We're speaking with Ilya Feoktistov, an extraordinary American patriot. He originally came from Russia. He's studied and practiced law here and is these days the executive director of an extraordinarily important organization, Americans for Peace and Tolerance, based in Boston, Massachusetts. He is the producer of the film Hate Spaces. He's produced and co-directed and co-written two other feature-length documentaries, one entitled Losing Our Sons and the other The J Street Challenge. Ilya, I just want to come back for a moment to this personality of Abdurrahman al-Hamoudi, because as you said, I think he really does exemplify the phenomenon of how Sharia supremacists, whether they're Muslim brothers or, for that matter, Shiite counterparts associated with Iran, operate in this country. Al-Hamoudi, among other things, created a prominent Muslim Brotherhood front group called the American Muslim Council. He became active politically with the Clinton-Gore administration, I think both raising funds for them and helping them outreach to the Muslim community. And among other things, he was rewarded by being given the responsibility to recruit, train, and credential chaplains for the United States military and the prison system, the federal prison system. Based on what we know about this fellow, who is now doing hard time in Supermax, how insidious is it that an individual with his ambitions, his agenda, had those kinds of responsibilities? And are you seeing in Boston and elsewhere around the country evidence of the return on his investment in a very diabolical way?
Sure. Prisons are some of the main radicalization centers in the United States, prisons and universities. He not only was responsible for appointing chaplains in the federal system, but he started a trend that has seen extremist chaplains being employed by a variety of jail and prison systems. So I would say, at least in Boston, there's a major problem, or around Massachusetts, of radicalization in jail. But beyond training the chaplains, al-Hamoudi was a massive organization founder. He founded like a dozen organizations, I think, with varying purposes, and including the Islamic Society of Boston. He founded an organization to promote anti-Israel propaganda in academia. So his interests were extremely varied. And of course, he spent his time raising money for American presidents.
Mm-hmm. He also built infrastructure in form of mosques. And give us a flavor of this particular institution that he helped start in Boston, and the two mosques, and the role that was played by the government of Boston in facilitating their construction.
So the city of Boston gave al-Hamoudi's organization a piece of prime real estate at a 90% discount to build a mega mosque, which is built and operating to basically radicalize the Muslim community of Boston, the historically moderate Muslim community of Boston. It was an inside deal. A mosque member was also the city official in charge of making the deal.
That's convenient.
Yeah, ever since then, the city has been 100% in support of this institution, despite all the problems that it has caused.
Yeah. And let's turn to the problems that it has caused. This mosque established by the likes of al-Hamoudi, a sweetheart deal by the city of Boston. The Tsarnaev brothers are sort of perhaps the best known of quite a number of jihadists that have been associated with this mosque over the years. Your outfit, Americans for Peace and Tolerance, has done yeoman work tracking these guys and establishing in, you know, very clear documentation their ties to the Islamic Society of Boston. Give us a flavor of the magnitude of the problem this mosque has represented in that regard, Ilya. And is this just coincidental?
It's hard to look at it as coincidental. And in fact, a variety of news agencies have been asking the same thing. Why is this organization producing so many terrorists and extremists. But the reality of it is the Islamic Society of Boston has produced 14 individuals, either members, leaders, donors, who are either dead now, in jail or in prison for terrorism activity, or are fugitives for the law or are awaiting trial for terrorist activity. Among these, the son of the mosque's vice president became the chief propagandist for ISIS. He was the editor-in-chief of the ISIS online magazine, Dabiq. And he was ultimately killed in a U.S. airstrike in 2017. But he was just one of many individuals. We had Lady Al-Qaeda, once the most wanted woman in the world, Afia Siddiqui, who was a very active member of the mosque. Al-Amudi founded the mosque, but it was financed, its construction, the old building in Cambridge that the society owns, by a man named Walid Fatahi, who has just now been released from Saudi maximum security prison pending trial for terrorism financing. So the list goes on and on. There are a variety of individuals. There's a guy who wanted to behead Pamela Geller and ended up being too impatient, so he went out to behead cops and was shot in the street. Former security guard of the mosque and brother of one of the mosque's imams who preached there.
So I'm told, all told, you've associated 14 different jihadists. Is that correct?
Yes, and those are the only ones that I can totally say went to that mosque.
Tell us a little bit about the Tsarnaev boys, of course, associated with and responsible for the massacre at the Boston Marathon. Who were these guys and how long was their association with the mosque? Did it unmistakably play a role in making them the jihadists they became?
So the Tsarnaev family came to the United States in 2002, April 2002. When the bombing occurred, the mosque claimed that they didn't really know them, that they attended maybe three times, made a disruption, and were kicked out. The reality, as I document in my book, is that the very first month that the Tsarnaevs landed in Boston, the mosque, the Islamic Society of Boston, was already looking for housing for them. Shortly thereafter, they, and we know this because they sent out an email to all their members saying that the Tsarnaev family is here, refugees, Chechen refugees, looking for housing for them. And they settled about a block away from the mosque, which is where they lived throughout their time in the United States. And slowly they became more radicalized. I know what kind of people they were generally as they came, because I came basically the same way 10 years prior, a refugee from Russia. We were as Jewish as the Tsarnaev family was Muslim, which meant very little because the Soviet government has beaten it out of us, beaten religion out of us over the 7 years that existed. And they weren't religious when they came here. They weren't extremists. The mother was a fashionable lady, and slowly she became more and more extreme. And as Michelle McPhee, the Newsweek reporter, has dug up, and she does amazing work here. The older Tsarnaev brother started becoming radicalized after he began to attend the mosque more frequently.
But so what you're saying, Ilya, is not only that they became more radical as they attended the mosque frequently, but they did attend the mosque frequently. So what are we to make of the statements in the aftermath of the massacre at the Boston Marathon, that they hardly knew these guys? They'd only attended once or twice.
I mean, those statements are predictable. It would make sense for them to want to do that. What's not predictable and outrageous is that the FBI bought those hook, line, and sinker. We had Robert Mueller, who was in charge of the FBI back then, admitting that they had no idea the mosque was connected to Al-Amudi. They never went and cased it. And ultimately, they went and did outreach. Actually, the mosque, the attorney the U.S. attorney here at the time, Carmen Ortiz, the first thing she did after the Marathon bombing is call the leaders of the mosque and ask them if they're okay and if they need any help with PR. So that's what we're dealing with here as far as our federal law enforcement agencies, although that seems to have begun to change under the new administration. Carmen Ortiz is gone, and I'm more optimistic.
Well, I want to come back to that in a moment, but just a quick further point on this. You're talking about the FBI essentially enabling some of this radicalization by turning a blind eye towards it and continuing to do outreach to the perpetrators. I was struck in the aftermath of the attack at Pensacola, the FBI agent in charge down there said that they always begin with the presumption that these are terrorist attacks. That's not been my experience, Ilya. And I think that, to the contrary, what we often get is, well, there's no evidence of terrorism here. And then they start talking to the mosque leadership in the cities in question and are told that they have no association there, nothing to see here, folks, and so on. So anyway, we're going to come back to what the implications of all of that are in terms of our elected officials actually understanding the threat we're facing. That and more with the author of The Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, How Boston Became a Center for Islamic Extremism, Ilya Feoktistov, right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest for this very special in-depth conversation about terrorism in the Cradle of Liberty, the author of a book basically by that name, Ilya Feoktistov, is with us, and he's giving us insights into not only what's happening in his own city, but really how it appears to be a pretty alarming microcosm of what is happening in a lot of other places around the United States. Ilya, before the break, we were talking a bit about this Islamic Society of Boston. And by the way, folks, anytime you hear Islamic Society or Islamic Center, that's a tip-off that it is a Muslim Brotherhood owned and operated or supported or associated facility. And we might talk a little bit more about what goes on in these mosques, Ilya. But first, just staying with the point that you were making a moment ago of the degree to which federal government agencies, including the top law enforcement agency, the FBI, the mayor of the city of Boston, and other political leaders in the community have essentially been enablers of some of this kind of activity, this radicalization, as you call it. Give us some specific examples of how this works and what these elected officials are possibly thinking when they do it.
After 9/11, elected officials, both federal and local in Massachusetts, began reaching out to these extremist mosques, and the outreach was very much reciprocated. The Muslim Brotherhood realized that a lot of image making needs to be done after the attacks. So one of the most important things that they needed to do is to show elected officials that they're working and the public that they're working with law enforcement. So in Boston, the very same city official who did the corrupt land deal for the mosque created a group called Bridges between Muslim communities and law enforcement. And of course, these groups were dominated by the extremists themselves. One of the individuals active in the group, Imam Abdullah Farouk, also a former prison chaplain associated with the ISB, is actually a extreme radical. He was the spiritual leader of Lady Al-Qaeda, Afia Siddiqui. He has been, we've caught him on video all around Boston berating law enforcement officials, saying that they should have been killed. Afia Siddiqui, who shot at a FBI agent, was a brave woman, and that his own mother would have done the same thing shot those kafirs, as he called them, infidels. He's the same guy who's glad-handing and smiling and embracing FBI officials. We have him on video also embracing our former governor, Deval Patrick, and praying with him. And we have him with John Kerry, with Elizabeth Warren, very well-connected individual, sort of like an Alamudi, Imam Abdullah Farouk. He used to be the chaplain at Northeastern University until we exposed his support for Al-Qaeda terrorists.
Well, and this gets to the point, Ilya, just if I may interrupt you. I mean, you at Americans for Peace and Tolerance and your colleagues there, Charles Jacobs and others, have done, as I said, an extraordinary job of making the actual record of individuals like this one and Alamudi and the others publicly available. This isn't as though Elizabeth Warren could possibly claim, just as an example, or Deval Patrick or the mayor of Boston or the U.S. attorney or the FBI director or others, that they had no way of knowing that these people harbor, you know, jihadist proclivities and ambitions. This is in the public record, is it not?
Absolutely. And not just by Americans for Peace and Tolerance. There's been coverage of this issue on outlets as far left as CNN, for example, which wrote an article about, you know, or did a segment and an online article about why is this mosque seeming to produce so many extremists and terrorists. So why they continue to embrace it is a very good and philosophical question.
Well, I don't know that it's philosophical as much as it's, you know, a question of judgment and of political expediency, it seems. I mean, we talk a lot about political correctness, Ilya. Is that operating here, or is there some perceived material advantage to these politicians to be embracing the folks who are unmistakably Sharia supremacists in these two mosques in Boston, for example?
Sure. And it comes back to the usual thing, money. After Governor Deval Patrick, for example, visited the mosque and hugged the Al-Qaeda terrorist supporting imam, they held a fundraiser for him, a lot of the mosque leaders, and raised quite a lot of money for his reelection campaign, which was then in full swing. So some of it is money. A lot of it really is also political alliances. As a supposed victim group, the victimhood of Muslims is political pay gold for far left politicians to use that as a tool to get elected.
Yep, get votes as well as campaign contributions. You know, I do have to say, and this is a subject for a much longer conversation than we can do today, Ilya Feokstisov, but one of the things that I'm persuaded of is that the role that the Brotherhood has played in fostering this kind of climate and successfully penetrating political circles was powerfully catalyzed by 9/11, partly because they were positioned as a result of having pivoted from working closely with the Clinton-Gore team to working with the George W. Bush campaign, along, I have to say, by an unlikely source, Grover Norquist, a Republican operative, to essentially have an opportunity to influence George W. Bush that really bore huge fruit in the immediate aftermath and the months and years that followed the 9/11 attacks. It's quite an extraordinary story. We have a book on the subject at securefreedom.org, Agent of Influence, I believe it's called, that gets into a lot of the details here, and I commend it to the listeners here. They're available for free at securefreedom.org as a PDF. But Ilya, we're talking about your book, and I just wanted to turn in the closing minutes of this segment, if I can, to a kind of related topic, and that is, in addition to suborning or at least bending to their will, American politicians of various, you know, levels and stripes, the Muslim Brotherhood and its fellow Sharia supremacists have increasingly turned, it seems, to electing their own to various offices. Tell us a little bit about how you see that at the moment, based on the research that you've been doing in Boston and, for that matter, around the country.
We saw it here in Boston first time on the local level. We had a CARE official, the Council on American Islamic Relations, the Hamas front group, get elected to the Cambridge City Council. And that was done with a lot of outside cash. Islamists from all over the country donated to this campaign. He did a lot of damage here, tried to run for Congress later, but I think he was well exposed prior to the election. So he pulled out. But we've had another CARE official try to run for Congress in Western Massachusetts. And we see Islamists like Ilhan Omar get actually elected. So while many of them lost, enough of them have now won roles. And we see the consequences of that and the vicious anti-Semitism she spews from her perch in Congress.
I want to talk more about that in a minute, Ilya, but to just stay with this election business. Am I right that it is the case around the country that the Brotherhood fronts CARE is one for sure. Another is an umbrella organization known as the U.S. Council on Muslim Organizations have been actively recruiting candidates, developing, you know, campaign war chests for them, pulling the Muslim community in behind them, all of which serves the larger interest, really, doesn't it, of the Brotherhood dominating that community. And we now see here in Virginia, for example, school board officials being elected from the Sharia supremacist camp. We've, as you've mentioned, had two prominent figures in the current Congress of the United States, Ilhan Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and many more on the hustings as we speak for the 2020 elections. Should we be concerned, not because these people are Muslim, but because they are adherents to this Sharia supremacist program, that they may have difficulty honoring their oath to support and defend the Constitution of the United States?
Certainly. I mean, they say it explicitly. And we've also seen in many other countries, Turkey is a prime example, where Muslim-affiliated organizations take over what was thought to be an ironclad secular constitution, the secular government in Turkey under created by Ataturk, and turn it into a country on the road to Sharia law, to Islamism.
Yeah, another Islamic republic, unfortunately. Hey, Ilya, we have to pause for just 1 second. When we come back, we can finish that thought, and then I want to turn to what you've seen and what you personally, as well as corporately at Americans for Peace and Tolerance, are doing to combat anti-Semitism that is closely associated with many of the forces that we've just been discussing. We'll get into that with the author of Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, Ilya Feoktistov, right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to the fourth and final installment of this extraordinarily interesting and, I think, very important conversation with Ilya Feoktistov, the executive director of Americans for Peace and Tolerance. Ilya, give us the web address for your research and other materials there.
Yes, it's peaceandtolerance.org, all one word, and spell out.
We're talking about your book, Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, and among the things you recount in it and in some of your other writings in various press outlets, Ilya, is the bizarre situation in which the Jewish community now finds itself with respect to the kind of anti-Semitism that is aggressively promoted by not just Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib, but Sharia supremacists more generally. And I'm interested in our audience having some sense as a member of the Jewish community yourself. You mentioned that you were not terribly devout when you came to the United States, but you know, however affiliated you are with the community, you certainly are very actively engaged in trying to protect it against the enemies within. And I'd just be interested in sort of your insights into the kind of resistance you've been finding from within that same community's leadership.
So many Russian immigrant Jews are appalled at the leadership of the American Jewish community, the fact that there are, and there's a lot of Israeli immigrant Jews who feel the same way, the fact that they're absolutely unable to see anti-Semitism when it's right in front of them. And the reason is that it comes from either the left or from the left's favorite victim groups. So after 9/11, the mosque did major outreach with all the Jewish organizations in the Boston area, the ADL, others, some of the biggest synagogues, and they got themselves allies, very, very good allies, because ever since then, the Jewish community has been, the Jewish mainstream leadership has been absolutely on the mosque side. So, for example, when the Tree of Life massacre happened, they invited the ISB's imam, Yasser Fahmy, to come give a speech at the vigil for the victims. This guy spews some of the most outrageous anti-Semitism about Israel, that the Jews are trying to take over the Temple Mount and stop Muslims from praying there. And yet they invited him as a guest of honor to speak with the governor and others at this widely covered event. This gives him cover for continuing to preach anti-Semitism. And it's been a major issue because as we report on the mosque's radical ties and anti-Semitic activity, the mosque's allies in the Jewish community say that it's not true and give them cover. And this is absolutely traitorous to the Jewish community here.
As you've documented, it's not just that they say it's not true. It's that they insist that they are the sole arbiters of what constitutes anti-Semitism, right? And people like yourself who've seen it, well, saw it in your native land of Russia for sure, but also, of course, you've watched, well, the Ilhan Omars, to pick one, but increasingly, aggressively, those who are, as they say, radicalized or adherent to Sharia are making no secret of their hatred for Israel and hatred for Jews and their desire to destroy both. This is something that it would seem to me that anybody, Jewish or non-Jewish, not some handful of so-called Jewish leaders, are able to discern and object to. Where do these guys get off saying otherwise?
The problem is that the major Jewish organizations like the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, have become basically the Jewish arms of the Democrat Party and the left-wing movement. And anti-Semitism for them is only useful if it can be used to bash the right. So when it comes to left-wing anti-Semitism, it's not only not useful, it's harmful. So they ignore it. It's harmful to what their true agenda is, which is basically to promote progressive policy preferences and give it a Jewish flavor.
Well, it's obviously an abomination as far as I'm concerned. And I just wanted to salute you and Charles Jacobs and your colleagues at Americans for Peace and Tolerance for your courage in standing up against these sorts of attacks. Another colleague of ours, Jonathan Houseman, has done the same in Staunton, Massachusetts. And I know it's a thankless task. I know you're obviously frequently vilified, even from others in the Jewish community. The Council of Rabbis, as I recall, Massachusetts Board of Rabbis, rather, is one of the leaders in, you know, trying to silence or otherwise castigate freedom fighters like yourself. And it's so important, not just in light of what you've exposed, Ilya, in this book, Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, about what's actually going on in Boston, but in terms of, you know, holding to account those who are engaged in similar kinds of activities elsewhere around the United States.
Absolutely. And it's local citizens, local residents of cities where this is happening, who are the best sort of soldiers, the best army to fight the situation. So we've seen the same thing go on in cities all across the country, but we've also seen groups of citizens banding together to do the investigations, to do the exposures, and to press their leaders to stop embracing these individuals and this movement, the Muslim Brotherhood.
Well, it's vitally needed. And again, I call it freedom fighting because I think that's really what it comes down to. You're in many cases in the front lines, exposing and holding to account those who are seeking to take away our freedoms violently or perhaps by stealth. Ilya, I did want to leave on something of a happier note. I understand that in part because of your efforts, the Islamic Society of Boston is facing some hard times financially and in terms of their ability to attract and dominate members of the Muslim community in that region. Is that the case?
Yes. Starting with our exposure of the mosque initially in 2005, its Saudi cash spigot essentially dried up. And without it, the mosque has been having serious financial difficulties. It's possibly about to be in violation of its contract with the city. It has to start construction on alleviating parking, and it has no money. So that's part of the sort of exposure. Sunshine tends to dry out.
The best antiseptic, they say.
Exactly. And the imam who was so embraced and feted by the Jewish community and the governor of Massachusetts, after we exposed his anti-Semitic sermons at the Boston Mosque, he has now resigned. And the same thing happened to his predecessor after we exposed his also anti-Semitic sermons that he did at the ISB.
And yet they keep hiring new ones. So, it is possible and necessary, obviously. And maybe we could just close where we began with the noting and mourning what was done by a Saudi national, most recently, in this case, in Pensacola. I'm heartened to hear, I presume, as a result of Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, that the evidence that he is seeking to heed President Trump's call to drive them out, the jihadists in their midst, is perhaps contributing, along with your good work, to cutting back on the sponsorship of this mosque. And it's also heartening to hear that, unlike in a lot of other places, the Turks have not yet stepped up to pick up some of the slack from the Saudis. But Ilya Feoktistov, this is an incredibly important insight into the problem writ large we have in the United States, though your principal focus is on the microcosmic example of your native city of Boston. I commend to our listeners Terror in the Cradle of Liberty, How Boston Became a Center for Islamic Extremism by Ilya Feoktistov. Come back to us again soon, Ilya, if you would. Thank you for this important work. Keep up the good work at Americans for Peace and Tolerance. Check it out again, folks, at peaceandtolerance.org. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.